hello, hello, I'm Danny Checker, your news dissector.
That's me, that's what I think. That's what I think.
The demands for justice, losing their hope. Working class solidarity, co-opted. The media.
Issues. That's me, that's what I think. That's what I think. Danny Schechter, your news dissector. What do you think?
And what do you think? I'm Danny here with Polarity One, Polar Levine, in the studio at PRN.FM. We'll be with you for the next hour on the News Dissector Radio Hour. We're going to be talking about some very, very interesting things you rarely hear about in the media. We're going to talk about the bank crisis. You know, you've been reading about how JP Morgan Chase has just been fined a tremendous amount of money. It seems as if the Obama administration is finally cracking down on abuses by the banks, or are they? We'll be discussing all of that and also talking about what an alternative banking system might look like.
Yeah, we're going to have Kathy O'Neill, who's right here in the studio. She earned a PhD in math from Harvard and was a postdoc at the MIT Math Department and a professor at Barnard College, where she published a number of research papers in arithmetic algebraic geometry. And she then chucked it all and switched over to the private sector. And she worked as a quant for the hedge fund D.E. Shaw in the middle of the credit crisis, and then for Risk Metrics, a risk software company that assesses risk for the holdings of hedge funds and banks. She's currently doing stuff at the Johnson Research Labs, and she writes a blog at mathbabe.org and is involved with Occupy Wall Street's alternative banking group, which I'm also involved in from time to time.
So you're the math babe.
She's the math babe.
That's me.
That's great, and welcome to joining us in the program. I mean, you've been involved with this alternative banking group as part of Occupy here in New York. What is it about? What have you been discussing? Why are you doing it? What are you hoping will come out of it?
Well, we're discussing financial regulation and the lack thereof out of coming from the credit crisis, and we're, you know, driven by the ongoing lack of accountability of the people that caused the crisis and the lack of response by the regulators. And you know, we one of our main things is to get people who typically don't think of themselves as having that much of a stake in the financial regulation to see the connection between the financial crisis and things that are going on in their own lives, in particular things like frozen pensions or Detroit bankruptcy, or, you know, even things like the fees that they pay on check cashing or credit cards.
So this is not really just about them. It's about us, too.
Absolutely.
And it impacts on us in a major way. And I think what we're coping with here is not only the power of these banking institutions, but the sense of a lack of power by the people to have any impact on this. And hence, you know, the banksters have gotten away with, you know, murder in a way, you know, and we're picking up the pieces.
Absolutely. And, you know, as a mathematician, that's my background, as you know, because you just announced it.
That's why you're a mathematician.
That's not exactly why, but as a mathematician, I think one of the things that is so fascinating for me to examine as a person, and everybody goes to Occupy for their own reason, and one of the reasons I go is because it's so fascinating to me to examine this fact that most people don't feel like they can have an opinion about finance. They don't feel like they can have an opinion about the financial regulation that's going on in Dodd-Frank. They just feel like they've been left out. And so the question becomes, how come people feel left out? What is the sort of, what are the critical properties, what are the salient characteristics of this industry of finance that makes people feel isolated from it? And, you know, there's a lot of answers to that question, but one of them that I sort of focus on is this concept that you have to be an expert to have an opinion, and that you have to have a PhD in math.
This is true, because I just told some people about a seminar taking place in Washington tomorrow on the shadow banking crisis. Okay, and the response I got was, well, this is too complicated for me to understand.
Right, exactly. And the two things about that. First of all, it's really not that complicated. And one of the things I like to tell people who are thinking about coming to alt banking, the Occupy group that I go to every Sunday, but they think that maybe they're not expert enough or they don't know enough to go, is I always say to them, look, once you clean off all the crap, all the sort of complexity that's intentionally put there, once you clean that off, these tales of J.P. Morgan's London Whale or the LIBOR manipulation or the robo signing, they're tales of moral sins. Like there's a moral outrage going on at the bottom of this heap of complexity and mathematical modeling. And there's no way that an average person can't understand this. And that's the first thing. The second thing is, going back to the intentionality, there's a reason that this is happening, and it's because it works. It works to isolate people because of extra complexity. And we've seen the Dodd-Frank and the response by the lobbyists to Dodd-Frank, that the more complex they make it, the better for the banks.
I mean, they want to create a sense that only the chosen few, you know, are capable of actually handling all of this. And that was the justification, I think, of Obama going to Tim Geithner, going to Larry Summers. They knew the industry. They were insiders. They could handle it. You know, whereas somebody who was like a former labor secretary of the United States or, you know, was too much of an outsider to have credibility with these guys.
You know, it seems... I'm telling you if you agree. It just seems on a more mundane level, if we just don't know anything about this stuff, then, we're not going to stash all our money in a box under the bed, right, because that's not safe. So to be safe, we give our money to a bunch of sociopaths to play with and to put in a box under their bed.
Yeah, and that's right. And it's not only the money that we have on hand, like our savings. One of the things I keep reminding people of is, like, one of the biggest changes of the financial system and the cause for the growth in the last 40 years or so is how people's retirement funds have been pushed towards Wall Street, and they've become one of the things that we care about the most. And we almost have no choice about that. And there's a lot of things we could talk about with respect to that. You know, for those of us who have retirement savings, the kinds of choices we're asked to make are sort of, first of all, you can't really make them. And second of all, they're non-choices. They're things like, oh, are you going to retire in 20 years or 30 years or 40 years or 10 years? And they're acting like that's
well,
enough
information. Well, actually, it'll be on March 27th, 2027.
I mean, yeah. I mean, well, there's that. But first of all, you don't actually know when you're going to be able to retire. It depends on how the market does. And the second thing is that that's not actually the right question. Like, the right question might be, do you want to invest in companies that you agree with? That's never asked, mm-hmm. right? So there's that too. But I think the real political power, so there's two sources of political power. One of them is the depositor money, which is actually kind of a small issue on the scale of all the kinds of money there is in the banking system, but it's a very politically powerful one, and it's the reason that Bush and Obama could sort of go to huge extents to save the banks, because they acted like the depositor money was at risk, which it wasn't really, because of the FDIC insurance, so that was kind of just a lie. But then
kind of just a lie. I just like the way you sort of slipped that in there. It's kind of just a lie. Yes, it was. Hello, help.
Yes, exactly. And the other thing is that, however, having said that, there really is political stake in having the market as a whole up because people's retirement funds are in it. And that's being used a lot. That is sort of like the real sort of excuse for why we have to do quantitative easing and why that's not just an absolute gift to rich people.
And also, you know, I don't think most people really understand how money is printed, you know, how the Federal Reserve Bank functions and how, you know, money is what they say it is, basically, not necessarily what we think it is.
Yeah. And money, you know, it's not a simple thing. It's not, you can't understand it in one sitting. And I won't even claim to understand it entirely. But what I do understand is, you know, for example, we were just at our Occupy meeting last week. We were just talking about quantitative easing, and we were saying, well, $83 billion a month is a lot of money, and it's going to investing in banks in order to give them easier access to cash and to prop up certain kinds of markets for mortgage-backed securities and the like. And $85 billion could be going to other kinds of investment, like in infrastructure projects in this country and putting people to work. But it's not. And it's not because the Fed has a different kind of power than Congress, and Congress is dysfunctional and obsessed with the deficit.
Is the Fed legally restricted to who that money can go to? Does it have to go to the financial industry, or can it be distributed in other ways?
And I'm not an expert on exactly what the Fed is allowed to do by law, but I do know that for what they're actually doing, it seems that they have pretty much one knob, which is the interest rates that they charge banks, and then they have this new mechanism, which is buying things and building a large, very, very, very large portfolio of stuff that they buy from the banks.
I know this guy, Bob Manning, who might know some of this legal crap.
Okay, Robert Manning. Robert Manning is a professor. He's a practitioner in the financial area. He's somebody who worked with me on the movie In Debt We Trust when he was a professor up in the RTI, the Rochester Technical Institute, or what it was, the university. No, it's not the University of Rochester. It was the Rochester Institute of Technology. There you go. I remember that. Bob, are you here with us?
I am here, and it's great to hear your voice.
Yeah, Bob.
Pilar and Danny and your guests.
Hi.
Yeah, we wanted you to join us as one of our experts at decoding all of this for the public and trying to come up with some practical alternative ideas about how people can deal with debt, how people can deal with money. Tell us a little bit about what you've been working on lately.
Well, you know, I've been versed way too long in the functioning of Washington, D.C. and politics, and as you know, my early work on Credit Card Nation was to try to better understand household credit and debt capacity, and then extending that to how the financial service industry makes that assessment. And for those reasons, I was very early in 2001 talking about the collapse of the financial system based on the fact that people were borrowing money to pay back borrowed money to make future consumption decisions based on the forecast of a exuberant bubble that clearly could not be sustained. And since that period of time, particularly being involved in the bankruptcy reform and ultimately the much more capricious bankruptcy laws that were enacted in 2005, I wanted to put into more of a mathematical way how consumers could understand what they could afford to borrow and what they could afford to save.
Hey, Bob, we have the math babe right here. We could probably solve this problem within the next couple of minutes, if possible. Do you need a new algorithm? We have one for you.
Well, Danny, I wish it was that easy to simply design the algorithm, because over the last 5 years, I've been trying to understand why there's so much resistance to an alternative system when clearly the existing one doesn't work, and it's not even designed to work. I mean, one of the things that's striking about enforcement and regulatory policy is that the financial engineering of the mid-2000s was very clearly done in a very unethical and illegal fashion, and no one's going to go to jail. I mean, that's one of your big points about the banksters, is that they're, you know, accepting $13 billion fines and penalties, but they view that as the cost of doing business given the extraordinary amount of money that they diverted to their own personal interest. Not to mention the fact that, you know, the cost of funds right now is bordering on zero for the banks, which has a huge impact on retirees and others that are, you know, basing their standard of living on bonds. But those people who actually have to borrow right now, because the industry is monopolizing how they're lending money, are charging double-digit interest rates, and that's one of the reasons that we're seeing such a huge increase in equity values in the stock market, whereas the rest of us are wondering, when is this recession ever going to end?
You know, it's interesting. It's, in a way, it's socialism for the rich, quite blatantly, because they're given money for free, and then they're charging us to borrow it at very large, you know, it seems like still not really regulated.
Yeah, so I just wanted to mention with respect to the J.P. Morgan settlement, first of all, $4 billion of that $13 billion was actually announced a couple of weeks ago, and they somehow managed to roll it back into a second statement as if it was a new thing. Second of all, it's tax deductible for them. It's another $4 billion gone. Another thing that you have to keep in mind is that their lawyer fees alone are on the same order of magnitude. It's something like $10 billion they've spent just trying to get rid of this stuff in terms of their legal fees. And so, I mean, the point being that you have to keep in mind that...
So it is an employment act for lawyers, is basically what you're saying, and big law firms,
right,
correct?
Right, exactly. But to your point, the Bloomberg editors recently came out with, and, you know, they're not known as socialists, but they came out with an estimate that the too big to fail banks, of which JP Morgan is one, get a subsidy of being too big to fail. They get a subsidy of about $86 billion a year. JP Morgan is one of the biggest, so they have a large chunk of that. So think about it this way. They're just giving us back some of their stipend.
Their ill-gotten gains. And you've worked with these people, Bob. I mean, you've actually, at times in your career, been welcomed into the inner sanctum of some of these financial institutions. What's that like, dealing with these people? What's their perception of what's going on?
Well, you know, I think we'll look back in retrospect that this was a new gilded age, because clearly there was a disconnect between the reality of how the economy functions for people who produce things and actually sell them, versus this era of financial engineering where people were literally writing themselves checks and patting themselves on the back about how brilliant they were. And then you find out, you know, literally they're creating asset-backed securities that they know they're going to fail. So they made all these fees originating and packaging and placing those bonds. And then they go out and hedge against them and create another small fortune. So these, one of the things that shocks me is these people aren't necessarily particularly bright. I mean, they just know how to game the system, and they have created so many layers in Washington, D.C., in terms of revolving doors of their favored law firms, that now you have people working in the regulatory agencies. And in fact, one of the most striking events that's happened recently is the outflow of regulators from the Bureau to the lobbying firms and the law firms that are now lobbying against the Bureau's enforcement policies.
So, once
you see how stacked the deck is, you wonder how we're ever able to succeed at anything in the financial realm.
Good question. Math babe.
Well, I just wanted to not push back, but sort of clarify on like whether these people who did all these fancy exotic derivatives are in fact bright. Because I worked in finance as well, and I have to say that they're very bright in a certain sense, and they're not moral, but they're bright. They figured out how to make a lot of money. And then in that sense, because they're not worried about systemic risk, they're not worried about pulling down the country, and they do not actually feel like they played a large role. Any individual person you talk to will not actually say that was me.
Yeah, they'll tell you about their charitable donations. They'll tell you about, you know, things that they're proud of in terms of perhaps some housing construction here or there. You know, and people say these are not bad people. These are good people, but they're just, you know, in a system that doesn't allow them to be as good as they could be.
And by the way, I worked with Larry Summers at D.E. Shaw.
Uh-oh.
It was interesting because it was soon after he left Harvard for saying girls couldn't do math. And that's a different problem. Okay, so Larry Summers, his problem wasn't that that he was like, I'm going to make as much money personally as I possibly can by being clever and like gaming the regulatory system. And his thing was that he's a believer in macroeconomic models, number one, and number two, he didn't really understand how the markets work.
He doesn't really interface with, you know, the people, Robert, that you've been connected to, have found that they've lost their homes, that they've lost everything. They've been talked into taking certain mortgages on that the people who sold them to them knew they couldn't afford. You know, there's a disconnect with reality of humanity in a way here. It's like a self-circulating elite that talks to itself.
Right, and the belief that Summers and people like him have And this sort of this certainty that because they're experts, they should be listened to is exactly circling back to what you said, that Obama wanted. Why did Obama want Larry Summers to be the Fed chair? Because Obama is afraid that if he doesn't have an expert in there, then the whole world is going to blow up. Obama is sort of like the one, the most convinced person I know of at this point that you need experts and they need to.
Yeah, like for example, if you want to build a website that works, let's get some of the best experts in there to build it. Bob, I mean, you've been around, you know, you've been in this rodeo for a while now, okay? And you remember when we did the film In Debt We Trust, the reaction in some circles was that I was, you know, I was an alarmist, that the film was doom and glooming, you know, that it wasn't really, it was inaccurate, et cetera. And then we turned out to be right about a lot of the things we said.
Well, and especially after we toned it down. I mean, after the whole discussion that shifted to Acorn and a couple of isolated incidents versus, you know, the potentiality that the system was not only at risk but was at a verge to collapse, and more people wanted to talk about what happened in a couple of Acorn offices than about what happens if these set of circumstances actually unfold and the system melts down. I was struck one day, I was actually meeting with Dennis Kucinich when he was still in Congress, and Paulson had just sent out his famous little missive, which also would insulate, not only provide directions in terms of what Treasury was going to do, but that all of his minions that were involved would not be liable for any prosecution. And I said, you realize, of course, Dennis, that this is just the first phase of the housing mortgages that are blowing up. There's all these others that in 3, 4, and 5 years that you're going to have to buy back too. And he screamed and he said, Paulson never told us any of that. He said it'd be all over with this batch of mortgages. And so, you know, you look at the damage control that was going on, and basically, you know, the consumer was playing, or the banks were playing with the consumer's house money, and these guys just wanted to get their fair share of the spoils and move on and let somebody else worry about the problems. But there was never an effort to really educate, as we're talking about on this show, for the average person to understand what was going on, because they were like scared that the average person was not bright enough to understand what was going on and would further exacerbate the problems.
Yeah, so on that point of education, I just wanted to spend a moment mentioning that my Occupy group spends a lot of time thinking about how to educate the public about finance, because this is a big problem. People don't know what's actually going on, but it's not actually that complicated when you sort of get the complexity to the side. So we recently came out with a book called Occupy Finance, which is available online if you Google it. And we also have a set of playing cards called 52 Shades of Greed, and you can Google that as well. And they're both educational tools and explain how you know who the villains are in the case of the playing cards, which was modeled after the Iraq War Most Wanted card deck. And in the case of the book, sort of just absolutely, here's the connection between your normal life and the credit crisis, and here's what's going on with privatization and pension funds and 401ks, and here's how banks work.
So please check this out. I mean, I've just been given a copy here. I don't know if you'll take it back before the show is over. Alternative Banking, a working group of Occupy Wall Street, dedicated to the proposition that citizens are both capable of and entitled to an understanding of how the financial system under which we live operates. And that's also been your mantra in a way, Bob. You've been involved with responsible debt relief. How can people reach you and read more about what you've written, you know, your book, Credit Card Nation, brilliant, one of the first real books to take on the system?
Well, there's a couple of things that I think are really important, and just give you an anecdote on my work. Certainly people can go to responsibledebtrelief.org or to creditcardnation.com. My most recent monograph was on the expansion of Walmart into financial services, and basically looking at how the Dodd-Frank period of review prior to the enactment of the law that Walmart was requesting a bank charter in the United States and got rejected. So I went to Mexico to see what happens when Walmart actually got a bank charter within the North American Free Trade Zone. And it's quite instructive to see how Walmart's strategy is to become a subprime lender. But I think what's really struck me is that everybody wants to go back to business as usual. And I've been going to Treasury and a few other organizations and asking a key question with our software system is, why is consumer finance and all the consumer finance management tools using gross income? Why isn't there a tool using net income? And why isn't there an empirical model for consumers to essentially self-assess themselves for underwriting purposes to understand, you know, what a real alternative credit capacity score would mean? So we've designed a whole new system around consumers being able to input their own financial information and verify it and cross-check it with their credit report and then calculate their own credit score and then look and see if they're going to get a car loan or do a mortgage modification net of the interest deductibility and their tax filing
status. So can people find out about that on rdrinstitute.org?
Or mymoneyed.org. The key question is, why is it that the federal government isn't looking at alternative approaches for people to better manage their money and hold banks accountable when they say they can or cannot afford a loan?
That is a key question.
And that's what I think is shocking, is that we really haven't made any progress there, and certainly then the federal government is not the risk manager of last reserve. They're simply protecting the banks and the bank interests.
Well, let me just say, you know, we have to leave it here, but we do appreciate your coming on and Kathy O'Neill, math babe and alternative banking activist.
Oh, Kathy, tell people where the Alt Banking Group meets.
Alt Banking Group meets every Sunday from 3 to 5, although we're having a pre-meeting meeting with a wonderful speaker series. And, Bob, I hope you can be part of that. And it's,
love to.
Oh, wonderful. It's at 118th in Amsterdam, which is a Columbia building called the International Affairs Building in room 409.
So there you go, folks. Ways to follow up on all of this. We've given you the information. I'm sure if you didn't write it down or if you want some more, you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org, and I'll try to get you that information. Coming up next, in the next half hour, we're remembering the Kennedy assassination, which took place 50 years ago tomorrow, and we're going to be speaking with the director of the Trends Institute, the very brilliant Gerard Colenti, who joins us from his super headquarters in upstate New York to talk about an interesting experience he had on the JFK assassination. But first, this little commercial.
We have a song.
We're going to go to this promotion now for the Mandela book that I've just written that we want you to know about, and we'll try to talk about some of that in a minute. We're out of time on this segment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mandela,
a lawyer by profession,
what comes to mind?
A tribal chief by birth, a revolutionary by necessity.
The prisoner turned president. Now his story, his long walk to freedom, is on the screen, leading many to want to know more about the man and his still unfulfilled mission for transformation. That's why I wrote Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela, to sing his praises, but also talk about the work still to be done.
We will not give up the fight.
He is like a modern-day Moses, leading the people of South Africa.
We will never surrender.
Let the walls of apartheid come tumbling down. Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Anyone who lived through that can't forget it, and who was part of it. We still, you know, try to have people talk about where they were when they first heard that John F. Kennedy was killed. It's an issue that won't go away. The American people, in a very recent poll, say they do not believe the government version of what happened that day. This is still one of the most debated issues, you know, among people who are not in politics, but even some people in politics have talked about it. Joining us in this segment from the Trends Institute is Gerard Colenti, Mr. Trends, an analyst of Trends, who had a personal experience with one of the people in the car with JFK that day in Dallas, Texas. And I thought we might start, Gerard, talking about that and then moving on to other subjects.
Okay, Danny. What happened was in 1992, and this is just weeks before, October 25th, just before the presidential election, I got a call from John Connally, and he wanted to meet me.
Remind people who he was.
Connally was the governor of Texas, Democratic governor of Texas, sitting in front of Kennedy, and he took the bullet in the back that went through his back, through his hand, through his knee, and almost killed him.
And this was the...
And then Kennedy and Connally also later becomes a Republican, ran for president a couple of times, and also was the Treasury Secretary under Richard Nixon, at a time, by the way, when the United States finally pulled its last string off the gold standard. So Connally was, you know, he'd been around.
The key operative in this period, and of course, that shot that got John Connally was also the famous, you know, shot supposedly that killed Kennedy. That's why, you know, the idea was that one bullet.
Well, yes
bullet,
and no, not according the story that Connally told.
Okay, this is what we're interested in. Yeah,
was that what happened was I had written the book Trend Tracking back in 1989. And it was a very popular book. And in that book, I had forecast that there would be a new third party. And for some reason, I mentioned Ross Perot's name. And Connally wanted to know how I had predicted that. And so I went to Dallas. It was myself, a fellow by the name of John J. Hooker. And that's right, from the Hooker. His great-great-great-great uncle was the Hooker who brought the camp girls around during the Civil War. And he was from Tennessee. And he also had run for governor and barely, just almost won the election. And he became a gadfly. He was against the campaign financing and the grip that the two parties had on the system. And Pat Caddell, the pollster, he was the pollster for Perot at the time. Myself and a woman by the name of Rama Fox. And that was Larry King's fiance at the time, because it was Hooker that put Perot in touch with Larry King, and that's when Perot announced his candidacy on Larry King. So she was there. So we're having lunch at the Anatole Hotel. And I have to tell you that my first emotion hearing Connally speak, I was embarrassed for myself. Because I knew this guy from TV and radio and, you know, newspapers, and I didn't like him at all. And I was embarrassed for prejudging someone that I didn't know, because every word that he was speaking was like a sentence, and every sentence a paragraph. And I was cutting off the other people as they were talking over him, because I wanted to hear what he had to say. So we're finishing up lunch, and Hooker said, "Well, John, the limousine's waiting." And we were off to the book depository, and his wife Nellie came down, and it's their first time back, Danny, since the assassination.
Wow.
And they didn't even go to the book depository when they turned it into a museum. And we sent you a photograph.
They call it the sixth floor in Dallas,
right.
Which is where Oswald supposedly was. And actually, through the window there, he shot John F. Kennedy, according to the official lore.
So we were parked in the front. That's the side where you see that window. And I was sitting across from Connally in the limousine, and Hooker and Caddell to my left and right, and Nellie and Rama Fox flanking Connally.
Caddell also, we should remind people, was, I think, Jimmy Carter's pollster, was he not?
Yes, he was. Okay. And that's what he became famous for. He was such a great pollster. And so Connolly starts telling the story of what happened that day. And as he said it then, and he said it differently at different times, he said, "I heard a gunshot, and I turned to my right." Now, with the way we were parked, turning to his right would have meant looking toward the grassy knoll. And he said, "I know it was a gunshot because I've been hunting since I'm a little boy." He said he explained how he was wearing a dark blue suit that day, holding a Stetson hat on his hand, and he was scrunched up in the jump seat. You know, those of us old enough to remember, limousines aren't like they are now. They have these jump seats that folded down.
Right, particularly in the front, that's where he was. The
front right,
with the driver to his left.
Exactly. So he said, "I looked over to my left, and there were brains on my shoulder." He said, "I know there were brains because my daddy was a butcher." And that's the way the story began. They went on to say how Nellie...
That got your attention, I would think.
Oh, you know, here I am, this kid, you know, I grew up in the Bronx and Yonkers, you know, and I'm sitting here with Connolly.
Right, we're two Bronx boys here, by the way.
I'm a Bronx boy.
Three of us here, so, you know...
And, you know, just to, you know, backtrack on this, you know, how life is, you know, takes its turns and how strange it is. You know, we moved up to Yonkers, and I went to Catholic school. Of course, you know, it was a big thing, you know, a Catholic running for president. And my buddies and I took a bus down to Getty Square, Larkin Plaza, to go see Kennedy when he gave his stump. I was about 12, 13 years old, you know. And as they didn't have motorcades like they have now. They had a couple of cars, open car. And I ran up, as the car was pulling away from the train station, the Yonkers train station, I ran behind the car, and I stretched out my hand over the trunk, and I touched Kennedy's hand.
And you haven't washed your hands since.
Here I am 30 years later now with Connolly, you know. So anyway.
This is interesting. Wait, just one second. We're going to get into this story and all of its nuance in a second. But I just have to jump in here because last night I was reading on Facebook a recollection by my brother who was at DeWitt Clinton High School in the North Bronx when you know Kennedy was killed and what it was like when the announcement came over the PA system and all the students were told to go home, all boys, and how shocking it was. And people commented on it, and one of the comments had an article from the New York Times that showed that John F. Kennedy lived in the Bronx, lived in Riverdale for 8 years and went to Riverdale Country Day School, something that most of us don't know because we all associate him with Massachusetts. But he actually, his family lived in the Bronx of New York City. Go ahead,
Gerard. Riverdale's not the Bronx.
Yeah, all right.
Go ahead. Anyway, so he's telling the story what happened. He said, you know, I felt a pounding on my back, and he put two fists he clenched in his face distorted. He said, he went flying forward, and Nellie threw herself on top of him. He said, you know, it took about, you know, regularly about 20 minutes to get to Parkland. So we got there in about 10, 12 minutes.
That's the hospital.
Yeah.
They just made a movie about it called Parkland.
And what happened was, now picture this. He's scrunched up in a jump seat. His hand is on his knee where he's holding his hat. He goes flying forward. The bullet goes ripping through his back, through his lung, through his hand, through his knee. Nellie throws herself on top of him. That's what saved his, as he said it, that's what helped save his life. Because as the motorcade screaming into the Parkland Hospital, there's a doctor that's on break. And he sees this. He goes running down into the emergency room, and this is a doctor that works on Connolly. Remember, in the midst of this chaos, he happened to be a thoracic surgeon, and Connolly has his wound and his lungs blown out. And what kept him from suffocating was him being his hand on the wound and Nellie compressing it by laying on top of him, or else the air would have gone in through
Amazing.
The wound.
And didn't they find a bullet on that stretcher with John Connolly afterwards? That there was a pristine bullet. I seem to recall.
Yeah, I don't remember that, you know, in the conversation that we were having. And so anyway, after he tells his story, you know, we go outside. Rama Fox had a little Polaroid camera. That's why that photograph of me, him, and his wife in front of the book depository. And all this is a Sunday afternoon. And again, about 2 weeks before the election. And he wanted to meet me because I wrote Trend Tracking and had predicted this. You know, he wanted to know more about my forecast and what I saw coming. So as we're going back, to the hotel. And by the way, there was nobody around that day in the book depository. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, like hundreds of people are popping up. Oh, there's John Connolly. There's John Connolly. And he was very gracious to everybody. Took photographs.
Well, of course, he was very well known in Texas as the
former governor. All of a sudden, this crowd just, you know, swells. So we get back in the limousine. We're driving back, and I'm looking at him. And I'm saying to myself, this guy's going to die soon. Because my father, may his soul rest in peace, had died of asbestos poisoning from working in the shipyards, and they had him on heavy doses of prednisone. Connolly's lung wound he had adhesions or something. They had him on heavy doses of prednisone. I'm sitting across from him, and I'm seeing the same symptoms that my father had, these big purple splotches on his hands. And you look at that photograph of he and myself and him and his wife, and you can see he's all hunched over. And my dad was a tall guy, too. And this is exactly what was happening.
Suddenly you're sitting there with him and thinking about your father, seeing in him what you saw happen to your dad.
I know he was a dying man. And I told Hooker this later that day. I said, this guy's going to die soon. And he did. He died in June of 1993. And we stayed in contact, by the way, Danny, until April of 93. And Hooker said to me, you know, that Tennessee voice, you know, goes, Gerald, my boy, he said, come on, you're exaggerating. I said, no. I said, I've seen this before. Matter of fact, I have a photo I keep at my place of my dad and I. But it'll be in the next Trends Journal, by the way, which is our publication.
But this is how history is remembered and thought about. It's not just some kind of objective reality out there apart from people. It's part of an extension of people's lives and their memories.
Exactly. And I have this photograph of my dad. I had, you know, going away party for him. He didn't know it. You know, his last chance to see Louis, and everybody came over. And I have this photograph of him, and you can see his hands. And Connolly looked the same way. So we get back to the hotel, the Anatole Hotel. And remember, Connolly and I are sitting in the middle, and Rama Fox and Nellie are on one side of him, and Cadell and John J. Hooker on the other side of me. And Connolly and I, the last two to get out, we're walking into the hotel, and he stops, and he looks at me. He said, I read your book, he said, Trend Track. He said, it's fine work. He said, I know your heart's in the right place. He said, well, you don't have a clue what's going on in the government, and neither do the American people, because if they did, there'd be a revolution in this country.
That's what he said.
That's what he said to me.
Wow.
And then he walked away. We went up to his suite. We spent about, you know, several more hours, three more hours. I'm listening to him and Cadell talking about Robert Strauss and this one and that, when he used to be the head of the Democratic Party. And it was a whole different time back then. And now, as I fast forward 20 years later, go back and think of what was going on back then in 92. You know, Clinton and Gore get elected. Those baby boomers, you know, everybody was excited. Oh, a baby boomer is going to be in the White House. It's going to be different. And the Cold War had ended. And we're on the cusp of the digital revolution that the United States is leading. There's this high optimism. And so if somebody says there'd be a revolution in this country, of course, I had already lost. I'm a political atheist, so I've already lost my faith in the political system. So
as only a Catholic would put it. Okay, go ahead.
So I had already lost my belief in the political religion. So when he said what he said, I understood what he meant. And what he was talking about was, you know, this is the guy again that, you know, is a Treasury Secretary under Nixon, that is the guy that told Nixon that the game was over, to pack up your bags and leave. You know, this wasn't coming from some third-rate politician. This is a guy that saw it all, telling me that the nation would be in revolution if they knew the corruption, you could see this guy had a broken heart. And again, as I said, I was embarrassed for myself having prejudged him. And then listening to him talk at lunch.
You know, they say today that, you know, back then, back in the, what we call the day or whatever, the Kennedy years, you know, things were much more, simple then, wasn't as complex, etc. And yet, the persistence of people who just don't believe the government version of what happened that day, the number of films that have been made, the number of books that have been written about all this. They you know, seem to be more every year as people pore over this reality or lack of reality. You know, I made a film called Beyond JFK with Oliver Stone when the movie JFK came out. Our assignment was to look at the factual basis of the movie and the people who he interviewed before he dramatized everything. And that film is part of the director's cut of JFK. It's still available from Warner Brothers, this film, Beyond JFK. We would have played a little bit for you, but unfortunately, and we're sure this is a conspiracy, the DVD player here at the Progressive Radio Network went on the fritz just at this golden moment. I can't believe it. And so we weren't able to play it. But where do you still think about this history, don't you, Jared?
Well, you know, I've developed a habit of searching the news every November 22nd. My birthday's the 29th, so I always remember this. You know, it was a week after my week before my birthday.
So you heard that here first, friends. Let's wish him a happy birthday.
Well, that's right. It's not there yet. But I always want to see how the Kennedy assassination is being covered or commemorated. So I've had this habit, and I could tell you with all certainty, it's hardly mentioned. Don't believe me. Go back last year. Go back the year before. About the last 15 years, it's lucky if it gets honorable mention in any of the media.
Well, you know, I disagree a little with you there. I think it is mentioned because it's one of the great dramatic moments of
Danny,
American history.
I can tell you factually. I've been doing this for years. And you have an interest in it because, you know, and you see it. But if you really go back, you look at the coverage that it gets. It barely gets covered.
Well, it certainly doesn't get the kind of critical and analytical coverage.
No, not even that. It's not even today marks the, you know, the 24th year. They don't even do that. They don't, you could look at the broadcast news. They won't even mention
well,
it.
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, CBS is doing a special about, you know, CBS anchorman Walter Cronkite's famous, you know, report. And, you know, in the midst of which he took his glasses off and cried, you know, the one moment of humanity from a news anchor about the death of Kennedy. But, you know, I interviewed Walter at some length. You know, he actually became a supporter of ours on mediachannel.org, and I interviewed him, and he was willing to acknowledge doubts about what happened that day all these years later. This is right before he died, where he was saying, you know, maybe there was more than one person involved. You know, in other words, he didn't know the facts, but he was willing to acknowledge that there were all these unanswered questions.
Why would anybody have any questions? I mentioned this is the 92 election. Read my lips, no new taxes. I didn't have sex with that woman, Monica Lewinsky. I smoked, but I didn't inhale. I'll tell you what, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda. Pick up the news today. We're going to be in Afghanistan now to what, 2024? I mean, didn't I hear Obama in 2011 saying the last of the troops would be out of there in 2014? Why would anybody doubt what the government is saying? I don't understand it. I'm shocked. How about the Gulf of Tonkin? Hey, you know, remember the Maine? How many more lies do people have to get hit on the head with before they know, again, what Connolly said, if the people knew what was going on in the government, there'd be a revolution in this country. It's in front of our faces. Look at the people who are running the show and have been.
You know, I mean, you are, you know, a truth detector. I may be a news dissector, but you're a truth detector. You've been looking ahead at a lot of trends and trying to analyze where things are going. You're not just comfortably reporting what happened yesterday, but you're looking about what's happening tomorrow. And I think that's what, you know, why so many people respect your work and the Trends Institute's work, because you are, quiet as it's kept, often more right than wrong. And, you know, it's not because you have divine wisdom, but because you pay attention to detail.
And I don't take a side on the issue. It's like when you go to a doctor, you get a diagnosis. You don't care what his religion or politics are. And that's the only way I look at these issues. It's for what they are, not the way I want them to be. But people put themselves in labels. They call themselves Democrats, Republicans, liberals, whatever, progressives, anything. And but I'm a nothing. I'm just I'm an observer.
Yeah, but I wouldn't. I don't think that equates. I don't think that equates with being a nothing, Gerard Colenti. I mean,
oh, you know what I mean. I'm
yeah,
not
I know. I understand. But I'm just saying. I mean, I'm trying to, basically, as somebody who's gone from being a outsider to being an insider to being an outsider again, to working now at the Progressive Radio Network after working at ABC and CNN and you know WBCN in Boston and commercial media, you know, I'm aware of, you know, the challenges that we have to try to challenge the level of propaganda, the level of ignorance, you know, in our culture, which is reinforced by our media, not challenged by it. And I think that you are also a devout reader. What is your sense? Do you think our media is getting better or worse?
Oh, it's junk. You know, like you said, you're on both sides. I began my career, Danny, at a graduate school. I used to run political campaigns in Westchester County for Republican conservatives. I was the assistant to the Secretary of the New York State Senate at 23 years old. I designed and instructed American politics and campaign technology that I taught at St. John's. And during the 70s, from 74 to 79, I was one of the chief government affairs specialists for the chemical industry in D.C. So I know what it looks
like. Oh, how mighty, how the mighty have fallen, because now you're on the air with us at the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm proud that you are, and I'm pleased that you agreed to come on, because you're somebody who is thoughtful. You know, you let it play the way it is, the way you see it. You're not trying to make it politically correct for one group or another group. And I think that's why people admire you so much, and is why we're here to salute you on your pre-birthday.
Well, thank you. But what I'm mentioning is, that, I mean, then you start growing up. If you start growing up, and, you know, I was in my mid-30s, and I started to say, I'm not going to do this anymore, you know. And I started to change and realize, you know, I was living a lie. And so when people ask me, when will things change? And that's always my answer. And, again, the motto of the Trends Research Institute, again, taught to me by my father, was think for yourself. So I'm only saying what I say. I'm not telling people that they should believe it. But I don't think anything is going to change until people find a truth within themselves. Are they living the lives that they say they want to live or believe they should be living?
How can people connect with the Trends Institute? Quickly, because we have to go now.
TrendsJournal.com, TrendsJournal.com.
There you go. Thank you, Gerard Colenti. Once again, we're happy to have you on with us today, and particularly, you know, to talk in a different way about the Kennedy assassination that, you know, is still one of the great unsolved mysteries, in my opinion, of our society and our culture. To feedback to us, you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. The actual URL of this program will be on my blog tomorrow at newsdissector.net. I'm also involved with mediachannel.org and MadibaBook.com, which is ran a little promo before. And we're going to go out with a song that actually Pilar Levine, who's sitting in the studio quietly with me, put his genius to. Tell us about it, Plunder.
This was written and recorded for Danny's film Plunder, and it's it questions why weren't these banksters, you know, prosecuted for any of their crimes.
Do what I was doing.